Eastern Brownie, I am Marjorie Egan. You are listening to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH.
You know what today is, Marjorie?
It's Friday, Jim.
Well, in addition to Friday, it completes 6 weeks with Jim and Marjorie on Boston Public Radio. You know what else is amazing?
God, that we've been here that long.
No, they haven't changed the locks. That's what I think that's the consensus. Well, in any case. In any case, there is a new poll out from the Pew Research Center. For the first time ever, a majority of Americans support legalization of marijuana. A decade ago, by the way, only one-third of Americans supported it. What's remarkable to me is it comes almost immediately after polls showing, for the first time, majority support for gay marriage. So we have a couple of questions for you at 877-301-8971.
Jim,
are you part
Jim,
of the 51?
Don't forget the email.
What's that?
The email.
What is it?
It's BPR at WGBH. .org.
Beautiful.
Thank
now,
you.
Now, as I was saying,
go
two
ahead.
Questions for you. One, are you part of the 52% of Americans, by the way, which crosses partisan lines, who support the legalization of marijuana?
Yes.
45 are against it. We knew that, Marjorie. And secondly, sort of a broader, I don't know if it's a philosophical question, these two wraparounds to a lot of people, turnarounds, pardon me, to a lot of people suggest that we are becoming more of a, I guess you would call it a libertarian nation. Our number is 877-301-8970. As Marjorie said, the email is bpr@wgbh.org. We know you're part of the 52%, and so am I. My attitude on most things is, if you're not hurting anybody, you should have as much personal freedom as you want, whether it's to marry whoever you want or whether it's to smoke a joint. And by the way, what's interesting, the percentage of Americans who used to view marijuana as a gateway drug has dropped precipitously. And I don't know if that's because of public education or what is it?
I'm surprised. But the people that were all in favor of legalizing marijuana back in the late 60s and early 70s were young back in the late 60s
and
early 70s. Then they had kids and they weren't quite so sure because they didn't want their kids to be little potheads when they were in seventh grade. Now that their kids are grown up and they've seen that their neighbors, who may have been potheads, you know, for 30 years, are still upstanding citizens, they're less nervous about it. But you know something?
Mm.
There is a weird thing going on. Because on the one hand, people are becoming more libertarian, gay men. Marriage and marijuana use. On the other hand, there are people like you and Mayor Bloomberg who want to arrest people for buying, what is it, 32-ounce sodas?
Not arrest them.
Illegal?
No, it's if it's more than 16 ounces.
Or to go to Walpole. You know, forget about the potheads, but we want to arrest the people that are drinking big sodas. And you'd also like to tax, like, ice cream and give tax breaks on broccoli. And who else do you want to arrest? What is the other thing you
want to
ban?
Anybody.
Oh, you want to ban candy. You want to ban candy,
I don't want to ban
too?
Candy. I want to tax it.
Tax
and again,
it.
By the way, the
so
court,
that's not very libertarian.
Just to correct the record, the court, despite the positions of me and Michael Bloomberg, decided that that ban on soda, sugary drinks over 16 ounces,
yeah,
did not pass
that's right.
legal
Thank
muster.
Thank God.
877-301-8970. You know, it really is amazing. The gay marriage thing we talked about, the turnaround was practically overnight. The numbers, it's epic. And as you look, we knew then it was 18 to 29-year-olds, 81% support it.
Uh-huh.
And people who now say, oh, I know a gay person. So that's obviously changing rapidly. I didn't realize that as recently as I said a decade ago, according to the Pew people, only a third of people supported legalization of marijuana. And by the way, you all know in November on the ballot, voters in Colorado and Washington State supported the legalization of marijuana for recreational use. But we continue to live in this era where technically that runs afoul of the federal government. And so in theory,
yeah, Eric Holder has done nothing. He keeps saying he's going to clarify it. That's the other thing. People do not want the feds to be rushing in, arresting people in these cities and towns and states which have legalized marijuana either for medical use.
Right, even for medical use, you're right.
Well, the feds were doing that.
Yeah.
So, and that's so weird with Barack Obama as the president, after all. I mean, he talked about snorting cocaine in his books, and never mind marijuana.
As a kid,
yeah. He was at Columbia, I believe, when he said he did a line or two. And he's gone on to become the president of the United States. There are a lot of rumors about George Bush with drug use, but we do know that George Bush had a drinking problem, which he quit. So, you know, I mean, when you're young and irresponsible, Jim, you're young and irresponsible.
Yeah, do you remember, what is the first movie that comes to mind before we get to the cold?
When Reefer Madness.
Here's a little bite. For those who are nostalgic and long for the... I think it was on on 17th Street in Manhattan when I lived in New York City.
Uh-huh.
It either played every Friday night or every Saturday night at midnight. Here's a very brief clip of the epic Reefer Madness.
And more vicious, more deadly, even than these soul-destroying drugs, is the menace of marijuana.
If you haven't seen this, you got to go get it. 877-301-8970. What do these two turnarounds practically overnight on marijuana and gay marriage suggest? Is there a big message, or they just should be interpreted narrowly? And two, are you part of the 52% of Americans who say, yeah, I'll legalize marijuana, or the 45% who just say no?
I think this is the legacy of the baby boomers, Jim. People say
that
baby boomers
haven't
done anything. Well, we have. We're the big tolerance group, you know, gays, women's rights, and pot. What do you think?
I think you're totally right. Let's go to Heather. She's in Framingham. She's on Boston Public Radio with Jim and Marty. Hi, Heather.
Hi, how are you?
Excellent. Thanks for the call. Go ahead.
I fully support having the legalization of marijuana for medicinal use, but I do not support it for recreational use.
Why?
I smoked it, and I know where it took me, and so I do not support it for recreational use.
Where did it take you, Heather? Where did it take you? Are you there?
Places I don't wish to return to, so I don't support legalization for recreational use, but I support it for medicinal use. And if I also might add, since you brought it up briefly in closing just now before taking the call, I fully support the rights of gays as it pertains to marriage. We need to realize that these people are human. They pay taxes. They work hard. They have feelings. They should be allowed and afforded the same opportunities the rest of us are.
Hey, Heather, before you go away, you said it took you places that you don't want to ever go again. Do you think alcohol takes more people to those places than marijuana does? And if you do, because I think it does, should we be talking about banning that again? Heather? I think we lost her. My apologies. Heather, thanks for the call.
You know, you do hear this argument all the time that marijuana is a gateway drug, and it certainly is for lots of people that go on to do many other drugs. But that's the argument. The war on drugs has failed. I mean, let's face it. It has failed. People are going to keep doing drugs, whether the government has laws against them or not. We've learned that over, you know, decades now. And you're right. No one is talking anymore about banning alcohol because it was an absolute disaster. And many people abuse alcohol. So the argument that many people abuse marijuana is not exactly a game changer for me, because I am much more of a libertarian than Jim, who, as I said before, wants to ban things he doesn't like big like big sodas
and people I don't like,
candy bars.
By the way, you know, on this whole issue of the federal government, this is so overwhelmingly bipartisan. It's near unanimous. 72-23 in this Pew poll just out said the federal government's efforts against marijuana, quote, cost more than they are worth, which I think is almost a truism. Let's go to Brookline, where John is on Boston Public Radio with Jim and Marty. Good afternoon, John.
Hey, good afternoon. Thanks for taking my call.
Pleasure.
So I support the legalization of marijuana because I think it will bring about more awareness as to the different strains of marijuana. And aside from THC, there's an active strain called CBD, which is less psychoactive and more medicinal.
Oh, really?
But it's impossible to get, obviously, on the street because right now it's just the high THC strains that are popular for sale.
Well, that is one of the things that's intriguing to me. Thinking about, they can't have any stores out in Colorado and Washington State yet because they haven't figured out how to set them up. But to go into stores and have the person that's there telling you, you know, like liquor. I mean, this is the higher potency vodka, or this is the higher potency marijuana, or this is the marijuana that does this or does something else, John. I think that would be sort of fun, even if you didn't want to go smoke any or eat any
right.
or whatever.
Yeah, I mean, there's pot now that is not psychotic, I mean, not psychoactive, and could potentially be healthier to smoke.
You know, John, there's all, speaking of healthier, and thanks for the call, Marjorie often mentions this, but you haven't yet today, the beauty, if I can use that term, of legalization is, in addition to what we said, is twofold. One, it's going to be regulated, so the likelihood of it being okay as opposed to dangerous when you buy it on the street is there. And two, we're going to talk to Governor Patrick in exactly an hour, who's in a battle with the legislature over how much money they can raise for things like transportation and education. Why are we not, if you favor legalization, why are we not selling it and taxing the you-know-what out of it?
Through the roof. I mean, think, why are we having casinos? One of the major reasons we're building casinos is to get tax dollars from the casinos. Mm-hmm. You could get, I don't know what the numbers are, back next to each other, but you could get significant, obviously, revenues from marijuana. Stephen just emailed. He said he agrees that marijuana is a gateway drug, but his perspective is it's a gateway to 32 ounces of soda and 32-ounce candy bars. That is an issue. I don't know what it would do to the obesity problem in the United States of America. Anna from New Hampshire. What do you think, Anna?
I'm kind of actually on the fence about it. I used to smoke pretty heavily. I'm 24 years old. Before, when I was in college, I smoked very heavily and had this whole argument about why it should be legal and that it's way safer than alcohol, which I still agree on. But after I don't smoke anymore, like, I think marijuana's changed a lot, you know, from even just saying the 70s, than it is now. Like, now it's insanely high, like, potency of THC, and it can make people, it can be crazy panic attacks, and it can make you feel really psychotic, and I think that it's definitely good medically.
But Anna, let me just stop you for a second. If you're concerned about the potency, and you really don't know, I mean, people are going to smoke marijuana, whether it's legal or not legal, and right. They really don't know. So isn't it better, as I said a minute ago, if it's going to be smoked, let government get involved, regulate it, so people know what they're getting for their money, and also don't get into something, assuming they don't want to go there, that's so potent that it causes them problems. Isn't that a common sense solution, Anna?
I agree with that 100%. I just, I feel like if it's, I don't know if it's legalized everywhere, if it'll go kind of out of control, or if it would actually be better.
Well, Anna, think about it now, especially, you know, and you hear this from kids all the time. How hard is it to get marijuana? Well, you walk about 50 feet down the hallway in school and you can make your pot deal, and then you can go out after school and you can get all the weed you want. So the idea, that argument of Anna's, again, to me, doesn't hold water, because, as you said, you would find out in the store what kind of marijuana. And it is so easy for children to get marijuana now.
And by the way, it would be illegal as it is in Colorado and Washington State. As with alcohol, they're going to make it illegal if you're under 21 to buy it.
You know,
now, who knows what the impact of that's going to be? 877-301-8970 or BPR at WGBH.org. What's that, Marjorie?
Well, I've said this to you before, Jim, but I think a lot of us, you know, as we get older, think about the prospect of being in the nursing home.
Be careful.
And I'm not going to make a mistake like I did before, but think
yes.
about it. You know, all you people that may have had a joint or two when you were in your college years, being up there on the little rocking chair in the nursing home, you know, it might get a little boring, might be a little depressing. Think about it, everybody getting out there, passing around a joint on the porch. I mean, really, how much fun would that be? Or maybe the brownies, maybe the marijuana brownies.
Hey, by the way, if you guys don't know where the count stands now, there are 24 states and the District of Columbia which have either decriminalized personal use of marijuana, legal, which is essentially what they've done in Massachusetts. You know, I think it's for under an ounce. I can't remember. Legalized it as happened in Colorado and Washington, or allowed it for medicinal use. I think that's 17 states. I may be off by one or two. I think maybe we became the 18th or the 17th. And instantly, you know, both the votes in the state, and correct me if I'm wrong, Marjorie, roughly 2-1 on the two ballot questions, medical marijuana and decriminalization. And that was in the face of virtual unanimous opposition by the law enforcement community, the attorneys general, the DAs, all those sort of people. So at least people in, I think, New England feel pretty strongly about this.
Except there is this great group of retired law enforcement now that
yeah,
they've
do,
left
right.
law
yeah,
enforcement
yeah.
that talk about how ridiculous it was and how they did not like spending their efforts on chasing down pot dealers. They just thought it was a waste of time. And it's an enormous, to many people's perspective, waste of money as well to have people in jail for selling marijuana. Let's go to Craig from Lowell. What do you think, Craig?
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Pleasure.
Sure.
I definitely agree with the legalization of marijuana as it pertains to, being above the age of 21. The tax potential, obviously through the roof. The ability to control the quality through the roof. I think that the kind of a fallacy that marijuana is a gateway drug in that it leads to other drugs. I think what it does is it leads to knowing the dealer who has other drugs that they can then push.
That's a good point.
Well, so, you know, this whole gateway issue, I know some people feel strongly on both sides of it. Most of the research I've read said that for those who go on to harder drugs, it's not because of marijuana. It's because of the psyche of the individual who was more susceptible to using that kind of thing. So I have to say, I've never read a persuasive gateway piece.
Well, there are,
Craig, thanks for the call.
Addictive personalities and there are non-addictive personalities.
Because that's what I was trying to say.
And I think it's the same thing with alcohol. I mean, what percentage of people become alcoholics? I don't know. But certainly most people that drink, a lot of people drink and never get close to becoming an alcoholic. Sean from Dedham. What do you think, Sean?
Found you.
Oh, my goodness.
For those who don't know,
Sean found you, he says. Sean was a fairly regular caller to our formal. What's that? It's Jim to you, Sean. Thank you. It's a thrill.
I'm great, Sean.
Hey, Sean.
Great to hear from you, too.
What's going on?
Well, a friend of mine told me you guys on the radio. I said, it can't be. And I was so happy to hear your voices.
Well, we're fairly happy to hear yours, Sean. Go ahead.
Now, let me guess, Sean. Let me guess, Sean.
You know, this is a great topic. And I've always been under the opinion that to allow marijuana, then what's next? What are you going to allow next? And you can't, it's a slippery slope. You start to allow this, then what's next? And we're going to keep loosening and loosening. And next thing you know, you know, what is heroin next? I mean, this is crazy.
No, Sean. Sean, you know what that's like? Sean, you know what that's like? One of my favorite speeches from a guy I like was when the former senator from senator from South Boston, Jack Hart, gave a speech against the bill to get rid of Bunker Hill Day as a holiday. You know what his argument was? Just like yours, Sean. He said, what's next? Thanksgiving, July 4th, Christmas. Very few people are talking about legalizing heroin in this discussion, Sean.
Well, Jimmy, when they start talking, you'll say, geez, a great man once told me on a Friday that they would do this.
Hey, Sean, we are thrilled that you're back. We really missed you. Stay in touch with us.
You sound great. Marjorie, you sound always awesome, as always.
Thank you very much, Sean. And I missed you.
By other person.
Okay, we have not resolved that one, but clearly we're moving in a more libertarian stride towards marijuana and towards gay rights and towards living together and towards all these other things. It's a legacy of the baby boomers. Now, for some of the stories that didn't make it above the fold, we're checking in with Callie Crossley. She's got her pulse on the important news that flew under the radar. That's next on Boston Public Radio.
I am Jim Browdy. She is Marjorie Egan. You're listening to Boston Public Radio. This woman's show, Under the Radar with Callie Crossley, airs every Sunday night here at 6:30. And she always spends part of her Friday with us. Callie Crossley, welcome yet again.
Hello, Jim Browdy.
Hi there.
Hello, Callie.
Love
Crossley.
That necklace, Marjorie. By the way. That necklace is fabulous.
Thank you.
Callie's looking fetching today.
She
it's
is.
For
what,
TV
what do you think
later.
About my outfit?
Yeah, it's good.
It's good.
Okay.
Let's move on.
Okay. So Callie, the Associated Press this week decided to drop the term illegal immigrants. They didn't explain what they were going to use instead, which is a little bit vexing. But what do you think about this?
It's long overdue.
Yeah.
I mean, I think the thing that the biggest issue for me is that the AP is considered to be the style setter for journalists.
Yep.
So for a lot of years now, other news organizations around the world have said, well, if the AP, the Associated Press, has not dropped this, then that's we're going to continue to use it. It must be okay. You know, there's a couple things to think here. We are journalists and we are supposed to be using language that is accurate. So I think that what Kathleen Carroll, who is the head of AP, explained is absolutely accurate. And that is, we want to describe the behavior of people. We can say they are, you know, doing things illegally.
Yeah.
But let's not label them illegal. That's just not appropriate, you know, to name a person.
So what are they going to say? Because we don't know yet. They're going to say immigrants who came here illegally.
Or they may just go to undocumented, which is, of course, that's exactly, you know, what they are. They are undocumented.
Well, then
you can go on and say, and they came to the country illegally.
But some immigrants' rights groups are unhappy with undocumented too, because they say even though some people in our constituency are here illegally, they have documents. So that's that's an inaccurate description. The problem I have with what Associated Press
think. I think for where we're talking about the group that has been described before, it really is about they don't have any documents. And they came and they performed an illegal act to get here.
But, you know, the sense I got of the AP when I read this story was, and Marjorie had, well, I don't know if you had the same reaction. After I read the first paragraph, they're not using the term anymore. And I read and I read and I read and I said, well, what's the term? And I know you two just talked about it. It's almost to me like I'm going to do the correct thing and then I'm going to run in a closet and hope nobody asks me the question. I mean, it's sort of, if the purpose of the AP style book is to give guidance to journalists and others, then give guidance. Don't say, don't do this, but then end with, you're on your own from there on out. That seemed, I don't know if cowardly is the right word, but it seems they didn't fill their full responsibility.
But I have to say that I have to believe that very quickly now they're going to come up with what they're going to do because they have clients. I mean, there are 2,300 employees of the Associated Press worldwide. Lots of folks, television and news stations, as well as newspapers, pick up all of their material. So they got to say something and quick.
Fascinating to me about this is I was reading these stories today about the Associated Press and the style book and so forth. In February, they changed their – they used to say if you were gay and you were married to your husband or your wife, they said partner, even though it was your husband or your wife. Then they had a big fight about pro-life.
Wait, that was just this February?
Just this February. Yeah. Then there was a big fight a few years ago about pro-life and pro-choice where they said, no, we're not going to use those terms, even though that's what the sides want to be called. They changed to pro-abortion rights or anti-abortion rights. I mean, they do – it's fascinating to follow history in a way through how the Associated Press changes its style or the big debate now they have about African American or black. And of course, if you're from the Caribbean, you're not African American.
No, you're black. Yeah.
So
absolutely accurate.
Yeah.
Yes.
Or
right.
Obama. Obama. Right. Was he black
or was he
biracial?
He's black.
Well,
in the United States, race is a social construct.
Yeah.
He is black all day long. And he will tell you that he cannot catch a cab standing out there without 50,000 other, people behind him. He can't get one. So come on.
Well, that's one of the things they were saying that one of the reasons a lot of your reporters decide is how the person wants to be referred to, too, if they're doing, if you are, say, from, I don't know, St. Thomas, what do you want me to call you?
Right. Well, it is accurate to say that someone who is a person of color from St. Thomas is black and not African-American because they're not. That's what's important here. And to the people that say that it's difficult to change these terms, that, we've used these terms. Why are you changing now? It's so hard. I just remind people that, it wasn't a long time ago that we were saying retarded.
Yes.
And now we say mentally challenged. Nobody thinks about that. Then you disabled. We move to, physically challenged. I mean, they're oriental. That's furniture people. That is not a human being. in case you didn't know, we left that long ago.
It wasn't that long ago, though.
Exactly
when I was little,
that's right.
It was oriental.
That's right.
Yeah.
So, you can do these things. I think the big nut to crack still is the New York Times. Everybody's waiting.
They're saying they're making their own decision, right?
Yeah,
on this?
But, and when it came up again, not long ago, like last year, the public editor said, well, we feel very comfortable with illegal immigrant, but I don't think they can stand there.
But, when you say New York Times in word usage, Marjorie knows this is one of my favorite stories about the New York Times, about how, I don't know if the word haughty is right. Remember Meatloaf, before he sort of lost it, the performer? He did his first album was Bat Out of Hell.
Yeah.
And there's a review in the New York Times of Bat Out of Hell, and it said it was one of the greatest things ever. Meatloaf, this new performer's come up with this great thing. Every other time they referred to him in the piece, they referred to him as Mr. Loaf.
Mr. Loaf.
So some people, I'm not equating illegal immigrant with Meatloaf kind of, but I'm sure you read some of these tweets. A lot of people think this is PC stuff run amok. There's one here, murderer is out. Obviously, this is sarcasm or an attempt at it. The term is now accused of unlawfully ceasing the life of another person. So there is a piece of the population that thinks that those of us who think this is the right way to go are just PC'd up to the gills because I think they would say, I don't want to speak for them, but I will for the moment since they're not here, is if I don't say the term illegal immigrant in a derisive way, and I don't mean it to disparage somebody, it's just common usage, then get off my back.
Well, I will not say what common usage was where I grew up about referring to groups of people who look like me, who are African-American, and that is not the word I mean.
Does everybody know you're a Southern kid? Do people know
that's
that?
That's exactly right. Yes. I'm from Memphis, Tennessee. And let me also say that just a moment ago, this is not centuries ago, this is not, you know, decades ago, just a moment ago, a senator stood on or a congressman was right there saying wetback and said his answer to that was it's common usage.
By the way, that was Don Young from Alaska. If you missed that last week, you should Google Young. And he subsequently apologized, but only after John Boehner, the speaker, told him he had to apologize.
Yeah. One last thing about illegal immigrant, though, and if you said this, I apologize, but it can to say illegal immigrant means that the entire immigrant from head to toe and in every moment of their life is illegal.
That's right.
And that's the thing. It's not saying an immigrant who came here illegally or who overstayed their visa or whatever you want to put it. You know what I mean?
By the way, and there has been evolution on this because as all these stories point out, prior to illegal immigrant, which is now out of usage in terms of the AP, it was legal alien, which, I mean, a lot of people found even more.
People are still using
that. I hear that really rarely.
I hear illegals, which I find really offensive.
Yeah, I thought the alien was Martian.
What else is on the list in your head? I should have prepared you for this. Is there another commonly used term that you find troubling? Troubling may be a euphemism, like illegal immigrant that the AP should say is a thing of the past?
Well, I can't know because I can't think of anything right. I'm sure there is, but right at the moment, nothing comes to mind. I just was the thing that struck me was what I mentioned, which is that, you know, when people talk to me about common usage, I want to always say to them, who's commonly using it and who are you directing it against?
You know, we were talking in the first segment about how quickly the polls have changed on gay marriage and on marijuana use. Think of how quickly they've changed on, you said the word retarded. Marjorie and I did an event for the Special Olympics even 4 years ago, maybe very recently, when their campaign, I'm going to get it slightly wrong, was to get rid of the R word. It was far cleverer than that. That was just literally 3 or 4 years ago. And the amazing part is while that was ridiculed too to some point, saying, please, I don't mean it offensively, you almost never, almost other than a comedian, you almost never hear anybody use the word anymore. It's pretty amazing.
Well, there was this sort of slang. People used to say, that's retarded in Boston. That was, you know, with the Boston accent. And you heard that, I think, a lot fairly recently.
And I think sometimes you still hear it. You know, maybe fairy. We just heard that from the fired coach.
Oh, the guy from Rutgers.
Yeah. No, that's, I'm saying, right. You know.
That was a big one when we were growing up. Huge.
That was, you know, that's, again, back to common usage. And I just remind people, you know, who's commonly using it and why do you think you have the authority to do it? And there's whole groups of other people who don't find that to be common usage.
And by the way, if you want to hit the guy while he's down, and I'm willing to hit the guy while he's down, he also used the other F word to describe gay people.
Yeah.
You know what, I know this is not what our topic is today. Did you read what this guy's salary was at Rutgers University, the public university of New Jersey? $622,000 a year. He gets a $100,000 bonus for having completed the 2012-2013 season. Do you think this is a professor at Rutgers University who makes even half of $722,000? It's obscene.
No, Rick Pitino, I just want to know what his severance is.
Louisville, $4.5 million. It's unbelievable.
Well, the Gulf Coast guy just left to go get $1 million at University of California.
Wait, the coach?
Cinderella coach.
Oh, I didn't know he left already.
Yes. I'm telling you, sports. Hello.
That's why you're here, Kelly.
So, update us on Magic Johnson. Speaking of sports, I miss this entire Magic Johnson story.
Yeah, it's really very sweet because, I know somebody's going to say something about that. I didn't mean it in that way. Magic Johnson's son, who has known he was gay for some time, and in fact, Magic Johnson and his wife, Cookie, have known, and then they, in fact, brought it up to their son.
Since he was a young boy,
and
12
said,
years old or something.
This is what we think. Why don't you tell us? And the son said, yes, I am gay, you know, mom and dad. And they said, okay, well, that's okay. We're happy with that. You know, we're happy with you. We love you. End of story. But he wasn't out to anybody else. And this past week, he was seen out walking with his boyfriend. He's a student in New York, in a New York college, and was clearly, you know, looking with the boyfriend, looking together,
holding hands,
and so that came out, and then they went back to Magic to say, "What do you think?" And he said, "We've known, we love him, and I am here for any other athlete that might think that this is a bad thing."
Here's Magic Johnson this week describing that first conversation with his son. It's EJ, right? Is that what he calls
it? Yes,
EJ. Here it is.
I told him, "Look, I'm going to love you regardless. Just let me know, are you or aren't you?" And then finally, he just said, "Yes, I am." And I told him, "Hey, I'm good with it. Just be you."
A friend of mine said to me yesterday, "What's the big deal? I mean, it's a nice story, but what's the big deal? The big deal is just like when
it's Magic Johnson.
When Magic Johnson started talking about AIDS, that helped change the culture in America. When Magic Johnson is so accepting and totally loving of his kid, that changes things too. I mean, it matters.
Don't forget, when he came out to say that I have AIDS, people accused him of being gay.
I remember that very well.
So he very well has experienced to some degree what the pushback is, particularly about an athlete being gay. What I think is even more important to note here in this story is that Kobe Bryant fined a great amount of money for uttering one of these slurs that common usage, anti-gay slurs, came out in support of Magic, being in support of his son and saying that's a good thing.
Good.
By the way, the Associated Press,
the Associated Press
just called on the phone. They said you can no longer use the word sweet to describe this story. I'm sorry, Kelly. I got to bring you up to speed. Okay, under the radar Sunday night, you're going to the Cape for one of your stories. What are you doing? What are you talking about?
This is a very sad story and definitely under the radar for me. There have been a little cluster of overdoses, opiate overdoses. Didn't know that statewide opiate overdoses are up, and there is a group there trying to help parents and family members who are dealing with loved ones who are struggling to get off these drugs. They're very dangerous, hard to get off drugs. In case they get near an overdose, they're training them to use this nasal spray that in the moment can stop the overdose until help gets there. So it's kind of scary on two levels. First of all, opiate overdose is up. That's bad. And then on the other hand, that here are these family members that are in this horrific moment that have to act.
But but there is a great side to the story, that there is something you can do. I never knew that.
No. And as a family member, one family member said, "Hey, I want my kid alive. I want my loved one alive. And I just have to hope that we can get them to the other side where this is not an issue." So great work by the Cape Cod Times, one of the regular under the radar contributors down there, Paul Pronovost and his team.
It's a great paper, actually. I love the Cape Cod Times.
Yeah.
Kelly Crossley, under the radar with Kelly Crossley, 6:30 every single Sunday night. We'll be listening, Kelly. Great to see you.
All right.
Thanks, Kelly.
Thank you.
Up next, the man who changed the way people thought about film criticism. We are talking, of course, about Roger Ebert, who died yesterday at the age of 70. Art and film critic Joyce Klahewicz joins us for a Roger Ebert remembrance. Stay tuned for that on 89.7 WGBH Boston Public Radio.
Listening to Boston Public Radio with Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. You know, most of us just watched and admired the late great film critic Roger Ebert. A lucky few actually worked with him. A member of that select group is with us. She's the president of the Boston Theater Critics Association. She's behind joyceschoices.com. A bit of a legend herself, Joyce Klahewicz. Hey, Joyce.
Hey, Jim. How are you?
Excellent.
Hi, Marjorie.
Thanks.
Hi, Joyce. Thanks for joining us. So what did you do with Roger Ebert?
Well, actually, I'd known Roger since the mid-80s, and I first met him on the red carpet, you know, at the Oscars, that we would trade Oscar picks and do live shots for WBZ. I mean, I was just a local reporter out, you know, in Hollywood covering this huge international event. And I said, "Hey, let's get Roger Ebert." And they said, "Oh, you'll never get Roger Ebert." And, of course, I called up, and Roger said, "Sure, no problem." I mean, he was that kind of a person, and we had great conversations for, you know, 10, 15 years. Then when his partner, Gene Siskel, died of a brain tumor, he rotated through a few co-hosts. They were looking for somebody else, and they called on me, and I sat in that balcony with him, thumb to thumb, for a year.
Thumb to thumb.
Yeah. I mean, and he was phenomenal. I had to pinch myself, you know, every single time. He was just the greatest guy. He would have the conversation with you. It was always about the movie. It was never about him. He had a voracious appetite for movies and theater and art. I remember he took me on a ride around Chicago one night in his car to show me all the buildings by Mies van der Rohe and, you know, the great restaurants. And he was just a terrific guy. We sat and we talked about the early days of, you know, syndicating the program and how I got some great advice from Oprah. And I remember sometimes being so nervous in his presence, thinking about, you know, that I was going to actually be sitting here doing this with him. Because for a movie critic, I mean, it doesn't get better than this.
Did he treat you like, hey, Joyce, he was huge. Obviously, the Siskel and Ebert thing at the movies was huge. Were you treated as an equal? I mean, did he treat you as...
Absolutely. Jim, 100%. Mm. And this, to me, was the most impressive thing about him. Because it really wasn't about me, and it wasn't about him. It was about the movies. And the enthusiasm for it. So if he thought you were worth the conversation, he would have it.
Yeah.
And it was incredible. And I remember being nervous. So he would try to calm me down by telling me a dirty joke. Oh. He was the best joke.
Okay, tell us one of the dirty jokes, Joyce.
I knew you were asking me that. First of all, I wouldn't even if I did remember. But no one could tell a joke like Roger. And he would tell me these hilarious things to the whole crew, and I would be laughing. And then I used to bring with me, because we take these in Chicago, I used to bring with me a little vial of something called, it's a homeopathic remedy called Rescue Remedy. Do you know this thing?
No, no.
Well, it's applied, it's administered on the tongue in like 3 drops out of an eyedropper. So he saw me doing this. And he said, what is that? What? And I said, oh, it's this, you know, it's supposed to calm you down and clear your head. He said, well, I want some of that. And I used to administer these 3 drops to him and to myself just before we would go on to tape our stuff. Now, nobody knows that. I mean, that it was hilarious to me, but he had literally an appetite for everything. He was engaged. He wanted to have every experience.
Joyce,
he was
Joyce,
down to earth. He
Joyce.
Had a capacious mind.
You're moving on too quickly from the Rescue Remedy. A lot of other people would like to try this too. Is this online somewhere, or did it work? What's the deal?
I think you can get it in drugstores. It's a homeopathic remedy called Rescue Remedy.
Ooh.
I remember when he first got sick, I sent him a little package in the mail, and you know, just tried to stay in touch. He was amazing, even through the illness. I mean, especially I should say through the illness.
We want to talk about the illness in a second and whether that even strengthened the connection with you, Joyce. But since I'm sure it's by popular demand, here's Joyce Kilhaywick and Roger Ebert talking about Gladiators.
We'll begin
best
here. I thought this was one of the best movies I've
really?
Ever seen. I thought this was one of the best movies of the year.
Ever seen?
And you make this film
of the
sound
year?
Of the year easily. You make it sound frivolous. There's nothing frivolous about this movie.
Whoa, it was getting hot in the balcony up there, Joyce.
But that's really when Siskel and Ebert were at their best, when they were disagreeing, because they, you know, they give each other the hairy eyeball and they look at like, you know, and it's just.
I argued, you know, right to the ground on that film. And I remember when we got
right
all done, he turned to his producer and he said, do you think we saw a bad clip?
Hey, Joyce, you mentioned that you sent him this rescue thing after he got cancer, and people know that he'd lost his lower jaw. He couldn't eat, couldn't speak.
I mean, this disease attacked him, you know, where he lived, literally, professionally, and in his life. The man couldn't eat. He couldn't speak.
Yeah.
And he was our voice. He was the one who made film come alive in at every level. I mean, intellectuals could find something in the movies. And every man could find something in the movies. He had contagious enthusiasm and a gift to make film transparent.
What did it do? I mean, everybody knows locally you're a 3-time cancer survivor. In addition to the cancer, what apparently either killed him or he got recently was cancer spread to his hip. What did that do for the relationship between you two, even though I know it was long distance at that time?
You know, Roger was not somebody to dwell on his illness or use that as a way to, you know, to get to know somebody. He was the least, he just carried on, you know? He carried on. I would say that I know he was in trouble a few times. He almost died. He had an artery that burst, and they thought they were going to lose him a few years ago. And I remember writing to him at that point And his wife, Chaz, told me that that he got that letter and that it meant a lot to him. I mean, that's, you know, but we did not dwell on that part of our relationship. And I didn't have deep contact with him in the last 10 years, but I stayed in touch with him. And the last contact I had with him was a year ago, and it was on Skype. And he was supposed to come to town for a book signing because he had just released his memoirs. And he and Chaz were flying in, and the day before, he had an accident. He fell, and he couldn't get on the plane. And you can imagine, you know, you're in quite a compromised state when you're not eating right. You know, you're being fed on a tube, and half of your face is missing, et cetera. So this really laid him up. So Chaz got there, and she said, Joyce, come with me. And we were downtown at the Harvard Club, and we went into the next room, and she said, we're going to Skype Roger right now. I said, oh, my God, that's so great. And we got him up on the screen, and there he was, and I got to see him, and he got to see me, and he was talking to me in his mechanical voice. And I swear, if I could have reached through that screen and hugged the guy, I would have. I was just, you know, tears were, like, streaming down my face. I didn't know it was going to be the last time I literally connected with him, saw him, and communicated with him. But something about that experience was just, you know, profound for me.
And Joyce,
I happened to
go to that book signing, and it was an absolute packed house. Everybody was there, and his wife was there. And I believe he said a few words on the screen at that event, because, of course, as you said,
he did through that mechanical voice.
Yes,
you know,
he did.
It was like this, hello, everybody. Yep. I hope you enjoy my book.
But
you know,
that took such... It took such guts. I mean, that is a very gutsy move to be in a compromised position like that and to get up
this
in front of hundreds
Roger.
Of people.
Roger was completely honest. Literally, what you saw was what you got in every way. And that's why he's such an incredibly amazing communicator.
Well, Joyce, can we go back to the beginning just for one second? While
sure.
he was the first film critic to win a Pulitzer Prize, I think it was in the mid-70s,
absolutely.
He was not the first film critic. So in a sentence or two, what put Roger Ebert atop the pantheon of film critics in the minds of most Americans? What separated him from the pack?
Roger had a unique combination of skills. I guess you could say any single one of which might not have been extraordinary, but altogether they were. He, first of all, had an incredible love of movies. He described himself first and foremost, and at the bottom of it all, a movie fan. So he had great love. B, he could translate that love into words that were understandable to everyone. He was linguistically gifted, writing and speaking. And C, he had intense curiosity and a roving mind. So he could almost like cross-pollinate information. You know, he'd take something from science and make it relate to the film, which would relate to an experience he'd had, and he made it personal and universal at the same time. And he did that. He could do that spontaneously. And he could do that in concert with Gene Siskel on the air, so that these were two guys talking, but these were two informed men speaking about something they deeply loved and cared about. And we were engaged. Their enthusiasm and their knowledge was contagious, and they had the gifts to be able to translate their thinking and their feeling into words we could all grasp.
So, Joyce, if he was so good, did he ever convince you that Gladiators was a crummy movie?
No, and it ended up winning Best Picture of the Year.
I'm with you, Joyce. I love Gladiator. That was Russell Crowe, right? It was a tear.
Russell Crowe,
oh,
right?
Oh, yeah, it was great.
Like a young Richard Burton. But I made him think twice. He said, do you think we saw a bad clip of that?
You know? Joyce, thank you so much for being with us to talk about Roger
Ebert.
I
miss him. I love him. Thank God we have all his words.
And by the way, there's a great piece on Salon.com that Roger Ebert about a year and a half ago about facing death. It's a really moving essay, Salon.com. Joyce Glahavik is
an art and
film critic. You can read her reviews at Joyce'sChoices.com. She's also president of the Boston Theater Critics Association. So, Fenway Park turns 101 years old. What better way to pay tribute to it than to find 101 reasons to get rid of it? That's what Globe sports writer Kevin Paul DuPont thinks we should do, and that's how he's marking the ballpark's birthday. He's up next on Boston Public Radio.
Knowing wealth, knowing you.
You're listening to Boston Public Radio. I am Jim Browdy, and she is Marjorie Egan. 3 days from now, as Marjorie said, the 101-year-old Fenway Park hosts opening day 2013. A local sports columnist thinks there are 101 reasons to put the park out to pasture. The man behind that sacrilege is going to treat us to some of the 101. He is the Globe sports columnist, Kevin Paul DuPont. Kevin, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Jim. Hi, Marjorie.
Hi, Kevin. Thank you for being with us. So you think that the poor old Fenway is just a creaky, ancient, geriatric ballpark, and we should get rid of it?
Well, I do. I'm way behind the curve to say that it's time, because it's been time for decades now, and as I pointed out in part of the piece, that it was certainly time to do that when Ted Williams left in 1960. I know it has been turned into this and romanticized to such a great place, and we do that in Boston with a lot of institutions and a lot of people. But I, you know, for someone who has been through my 60 years, who has spent many of those years, I guess, in terms of just sitting in the place, it's very uncomfortable, extremely uncomfortable. Many bad seats. I know the romanticism, but how about a real place?
Well, Kevin, are you talking about moving it from Kenmore Square or rebuilding it in Kenmore Square?
Well, they own quite a bit of land there now. I don't know how much. I don't know if they've got enough to start tearing down buildings and then infringe on that area that currently holds the ballpark. But they really blew their chance about 10 or 12 years ago when, prior to this ownership, another place that I know quite well, BU, because I was a student there, BU bought the Commonwealth Armory, an old Braves field, butts where that used to be, and that's Nickerson Field and the West Campus. It would have been a perfect opportunity to do a land swap, have the new Fenway Park built down there, and make a land swap with the current Fenway and let BU actually have a cloistered campus in Kenmore Square. That never happened. I don't think it ever really got on anybody's radar. But where would I like to stay? I'd love to see it there. I suppose the Seaport area is built out to such a degree now they probably couldn't. But I love the idea of an in-town ballpark.
So do I
can't see that they would ever get away from that.
We're talking to Kevin Paul DuPont from the Globe, 877-301-8970. Here's my thesis, Kevin. As someone who's 6 feet 5 inches tall, and I'll keep my weight to myself.
Who can't get out of the seat at the seventh inning stretch,
exactly.
Kevin.
There are two kinds. We spoke to Sam Kennedy the other day, the chief operating officer of the Red Sox, and we said this to him. There are two kinds of people in my estimation. Those who want Fenway to stay as it is are, for the most part, under 5'7 and 150 pounds, and anybody taller and heavier wants it to go. Literally, it is a throwback to an as beautiful and as wonderful as it is when you come out and see that field and the green on a hot summer day. It is so out of date. It is unbelievable. So why the resistance? Is it all about money or is it about tradition?
I think it is the tradition, although I have to say the resistance, I was very surprised with this piece that ran on Sunday. I would say the vast majority, 80 if not 90% of the people who responded, and usually, as you guys know, they usually respond when they're angry.
Right.
80 to 90% were in favor of a new Fenway. I was astounded by that, and I wasn't writing this to be some contrarian or rabble-rouser here. It's just how I feel. I did get a small percentage, including the Save Fenway crowd, which interestingly responded with, you could tell, basically a boilerplate piece of the reasons to keep it. I understand that. It's a museum, and it's where my dad went, and his dad went, and everybody else's dad and uncle and cousin and Aunt Mary and Sister Mary Joseph from Nun's Day and the rest of it.
Abraham Lincoln saw his first game there.
Yeah, exactly.
I think so. George Washington, actually.
If you want to weigh in quickly on either side of this, 877-301-8970. I assume your colleague Dan Shaughnessy wants a new stadium so he can write a new book. That's for sure. But, you know, I have to, you know, when you go through this, I haven't been to some of the great stadiums in America. I haven't been to, you know, like Camden Yards in Baltimore or the stadium in Texas. But it eeks oldness. And when you walk through they've done remarkable work considering what they have to work
with.
Absolutely. But when you walk through the concourse, it is so dark and dreary. And as you say, if you haven't sat in those seats that don't even face home plate, it's like a bad joke on people. But the reality is that it seems to me, as someone who doesn't understand economics that well, at least economics of sports, the ownership has invested so much money in additional seats and upgrading what is, that the likelihood of this ownership, as wealthy as they are, ever doing a new stadium is virtually zero, right?
I would think so. On top of that, which is they've spent upward of, I think, $200 million to do the rehab they have done. So they'd have to amortize that over how many years of the new place with, say, 10,000 more seats in it. And then, in many ways, the small ballpark here works in their favor because tickets are so scarce, people want to have them. That in itself drives the gate. So if you move to 45,000, would you get 37, 38, 39,000 regularly?
Well,
probably
that's not. Kevin, that's the big thing. We're talking, by the way, with Kevin Paul DuPont from the Boston Globe, who thinks that we need to rebuild Fenway Park and possibly even move Fenway Park. That's one of the things I've heard about Yankee Stadium, is that now that they've rebuilt the new Yankee Stadium and people were moaning about all the tradition there and Joe DiMaggio, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, now they go to the new Yankee Stadium and the tickets are really cheap out there in the bleachers and you can get them, which is, you know, now you can get them at the Red Sox too.
Yeah, but they're $2,000 behind home plate, so there's a cost for a $1 billion stadium.
Yeah, but it's a beautiful new. I haven't heard many complaints, is my point, about the new Yankee Stadium, even though they are far from home plate. What do you think of the new Yankee Stadium?
Well, I haven't been there for baseball. I was actually there for a boxing match when it first opened. But when you're in it, it's a very comfortable place. I think their biggest issue right now with the stands isn't so much price, and the pricing has been a problem on the seats close to the field, the box seats or the executive boxes or whatever they term them. Their problem right now is they've got a god-awful team.
Yeah, that makes us happy.
You know, Kevin,
that's right.
The best part of what you said so far is whether there's an old stadium that continues for another 101 years or a new one, the fact that in an era where you have to drive an hour in some major cities to get to a ballpark or a football game or whatever, the fact that this is in the center, forget even South Boston, the waterfront, even if there was room, the fact that you can take the subway to the thing, you can walk in many instances on a summer day. I mean, how great, doesn't that sort of fit the feel of what baseball was when you were a kid? I mean, that's what I love about it.
Sure, absolutely. So you're talking about ballparks that were built at the late 1800s, early 1900s. The only other one that comes close now is Wrigley in Chicago. Right. But sure, cities weren't overbuilt, and they weren't $800,000 condominiums. The land was there, and they could do them. It's a much trickier fit here in New England, specifically Boston, because of what's happened with real estate downtown. I would be blown away if they ever did their balance to Foxborough. If they ever went to the suburbs, I think it'd be a tragic mistake. Frankly, I know the Patriots have done well out there. I can't stand going out there.
I hate it, too.
Neither can I. And you know what's incredible? Because I had to drive through Kenmore Square all the time going home. Even on game days, the traffic is not a big deal in Kenmore Square. I mean, maybe a little bit delayed when they're going in or coming out, but it's not bad at all. So, Kevin, you just had the Yankees have a lousy team this year. How are the Red Sox going to do it? Give us a prediction.
Well, I had to say, I thought going in, they'd be right around 500, be it 84, 86, 88 wins. I've really been encouraged by what I've seen. However, the caveat here is it's such a junior varsity squad in the Bronx, it's hard to get a measure. But having watched them for these three games and through spring training, it seems to me they won't lose 6 in a row, 8 in a row, 10 in a row with a regularity. I think they can always be around 500, and given the new system, they might cheat around and maybe get a wild card.
Okay, Kevin, this is when the rubber hits the road.
Okay.
How old will your grandchild be when there is a new Fenway Park? I want it within 5 years, Kevin. No BS.
Yeah, well, when he's sitting in his $350 box seat, he's confused over that.
Kevin, thank you very much for being with us, and thanks for a great piece about rebuilding Fenway. Kevin Paul DuPont is a sports columnist for the Boston Globe. Up next is Open Mic with Emily Rooney, who's fit to be tied about, well, actually, stay tuned and find out what she's fit to be tied about. That's next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
You're listening to Boston Public Radio with Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. Marjorie just described our next guest, our colleague, as fit to be tied, which is always
She's
a safe bet,
up.
I should say. You see her every night on GBH TV. You hear her every Friday at 1 with us. She, of course, is the MBTA phobic. Emily Rooney, welcome.
I do have a few issues, don't I? You do have a few issues, but that's okay.
We're glad.
We need them. So we just talked with Callie Crossey about this whole thing, the Associated Press style, but kind of the Bible for journalists and the media in general has decided this week they're no longer going to use the term illegal immigrant, though they haven't said what they are going to use, which is a little odd. So what do you think about
this?
Well,
good for them. But that doesn't mean we all have to go along with it. I don't know. I started thinking about terminology. I was actually looking up some words today that I really don't like. I don't like the word lesbian. I don't like it. It has an ugly connotation. It's often used in a very ugly manner. And it also has this weird derivation from the island Lesbos and all that. But
do lesbians object to being called lesbians?
They object. Well, I'll tell you what they do object to. The lesbian gay community objects to being called homosexual. Mm. They don't want we in the media to use that term. Well, this is, you know, an accurate descriptive term, as is illegal immigrant. As Janet Napolitano says, it's shorthand in a sense. It is, they're here illegally and they're immigrants. So it's a shorthand. And to say, it's suggesting that the person themselves is illegal. No, it doesn't. It doesn't suggest that the person is illegal.
That was my argument 5 minutes ago. I guess you shot me.
So you're going to keep using it? Do you use it, first of all?
Well, I mean, we all used to use illegal alien. Now, that I can understand. We sort of moved away from that. But I can't – I'm not convinced that I have to move on to undocumented worker or what was the one undocumented migrant. That was one of the ones they suggested. It's like,
well, how about just immigrants who are here illegally?
Well, no one's using eight words.
But listen,
Marjorie,
that's the thing. It's shorthand, especially in journalism. We often, turn to shorthand for things that doesn't make it inaccurate or, frankly, wrong. And offense is a whole other category of things. And as I say, if you look at the – we just got this handbook from the gay, lesbian, transgender community, and they don't want us to use the word homosexual because it has been used in very derogatory and ugly terms. As has the term lesbian, which, by the way, no one does complain about, but I don't like that term. Men are called gay. How did that happen? How did that get to be – gay get to be homosexual, but not lesbian. You don't call lesbians gay.
Well, how about the – because lots of people – I've run into this as a reporter. What do you want me to call you? Mm-hmm. Do you want me to call you African-American? Do you want me to call you Caribbean-American? What are you?
I just looked that up, too. And, the whole derivation of Negro and why that became unacceptable. And that was really a civil rights movement issue. But it also had – derivations very much like lesbian and going back to
where it came
from.
So should every constituency basically be able to say, here's what I want to be called?
No.
Remember Afro-American? There was Afro-American
for a while.
Of course
I do. Can we get back to this lesbian thing for a second? I have to say,
I know.
It's the first time ever.
I don't know
if it's a thing with you. That's a topic for another segment.
Yeah, you, Jim.
But no, I'm serious. No, please. Can we just – no, let's not get it. No, 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 no. Let's not get into that. No,
okay.
But who's complaining?
Nobody. Me. I don't like it.
But there's nobody in the lesbian community who is saying they're upset. And so your concern is that some people spew it out in a pejorative.
Exactly. It's used in a very ugly – it is.
Okay, fine.
Now, the only people that use the word homosexual anymore are people that are anti-homosexual.
That's their point.
Yeah.
But that's wrong. It's still a valid term.
It sounds like a clinical
thing.
Well,
see, you're buying
into the doctor's office or something.
But I mean – again, where did gay come from?
I don't know. Where did gay come from?
And I'd much rather, if I were a lesbian, I'd much rather be called gay. It has kind of a sort of sweet.
Well, les, it's the L-E-S.
Yeah, no,
it sounds weird.
Okay, fine. By the way, an illegal immigrant, we could just do double I.
They're all hiding their hands in the control. They're going, I can't believe she's getting into this.
I'm appalled with her, too. I just want to vote. Now, okay, a couple of weeks ago, after John Connolly, the city councilor, announced, I think I'm quoting you as having said, John Connolly is the real deal.
Yes.
Well, I saw last night you interviewed the newest Connolly. It's spelled differently, pronounced differently. Dan Connolly, Suffolk County DA. Is he the real deal,
Absolutely.
Too?
Absolutely. He's the real deal.
Who isn't the real deal?
Oh, I think there's going to be several candidates getting into the race who are probably not the real deal.
Why is Dan Connolly the real deal? Because $850,000?
Oh,
because
I don't think it's just because
what
of the money.
What is it?
I think he's got... I think he's got real credibility. He was a city councilor.
Yep.
I mean, he really does understand the communities of not just Suffolk County, although Suffolk County is critical, let's face it, because that's the biggest county that the mayor is going to be dealing with. In fact, the only
county.
So
what's it include? Winthrop and is it Revere or no? Whatever it is. But in any case, Boston is all in Suffolk County. Go ahead.
I mean, and actually, you know, I think he's got
a good record as a DA.
Good record as a DA. And I really like something about his manner, too. Unlike somebody like John McCain, who I always feel like he's holding back. He's really about to explode any minute. Dan Conley has that same kind of very reassuring demeanor, but you don't think he's about to explode at any minute.
I'm going to break some news here I was going to save for my TV show. John McCain is not running for mayor. I spoke to him last night. So who is on the sidelines? You know, one of the things, who is on the sidelines who you think is another real dealer, for lack of a better expression, who may enter? We've learned in the last couple of days, Tito Jackson is not running.
No. Not running.
Andrew
Jim
Cabral
Rooney,
told us running. Last not week, running. Not running. Sonia Chang Diaz said yesterday, not running. By the way, interestingly, every single person of color or woman who was on the list, maybe with the exception of Ayanna Pressley, has ruled themselves out. Who
you may
credible?
Have the two most serious candidates
already in the
already
race.
In
is
the
there
race.
Somebody else on the sidelines?
I think Felix Arroyo is a popular guy. He came in second in the last council race on his own steam, and you know he's young and he's not that experienced.
I like him,
but I think he's got some potential. Mm-hmm. I really do.
Well, so it would seem to me in a majority-minority city, if you've got a decent record, you have some credibility, you have a personality. Felix Arroyo has a big personality, I think.
Big
I just met him for the first time recently. For people don't know, if you don't live in Boston, you have to ultimately make it into the final two. You have to win a majority, just not a plurality.
It's interesting, too, because Dan Conley is a Republican, but that doesn't matter in the mayor's
Dan
race.
Dan Conley is a Republican? I did not know that.
Seriously? Oh, my
I
God,
did not
Jim. You may have
that.
To change your whole allegiance
Dan
here.
Dan Conley is a Republican?
Yes.
I am stunned.
Did it really?
I'm not being facetious. I had no idea he was a Republican.
It doesn't matter, though, because
of course,
it's nonpartisan or not.
Wow.
Yeah, we just have an email from Art from West Bridgewater asking if Conley has to give up his DA position to run for mayor. I believe he does not.
No, he does not. And can I say, one of my pet peeves, I was a big fan of Mike Dukakis, but the notion, it's one thing if you're a United States senator, even though that troubles me because you're part of a board of directors, the notion that somebody who has an executive job as DA or governor or something like that, or mayor, who runs for higher office and pretends that he or she can devote adequate attention to the job that they are paid and hired to do. That doesn't bother you?
It does bother me. It's
step
it's
down and run
me.
For the job.
I know. People hang on to these jobs. It's impossible at some point. Running for governor, running for president, if you're a senator, you can't do both.
I agree. Well, you know, the only thing worse than that, which, and I, no, there is one thing worse than that, which is a parallel thing, is when candidates, I think Paul Ryan, I'm sure Paul Ryan just did this, Joe Lieberman did it in Connecticut, when they run for president or vice president, their state law, every state law is different, allows them to run simultaneously for the office they hold. So when Lieberman, for example, was running,
I think
for president or vice president, he was running for re-election in the United States Senate. Paul Ryan is running for re-election in Wisconsin to the House of Representatives while he's running.
We're agreeing with you.
Oh, we are? Yeah. So we can move on?
But there is something that Jim won't agree with us on, because I'm with you on this one, Emily. Cigarette taxes.
Oh, yeah. That's ridiculous.
Give us your spiel.
Part of the legislature's mix. We're going to talk to Deval Patrick in 5 minutes. Obviously, he wasn't advancing the cigarette tax, but what's your take on
this? It is such a cheap, cheap fallback to go after the people who have a nasty habit. Who among us, who doesn't here have some kind of a habit? Should everything that we don't like be taxed? I don't like boxing. Are we going to tax that too? Let's get a petition going.
She's fit to be tied.
I am fit to be tied. But by the way, I don't smoke. You know, I really don't like being around smokers. You know, but knock yourselves out if you want to smoke. Just don't drop your butts on the sidewalk. That drives me crazy. But to be taxing people who have a habit, and it's such a cheap fallback because who's going to say, except for a few and a handful of smokers, who's going to say, oh, yeah, well, you know, that's not the right thing to do.
It's also that everybody, including Jim Browdy over here, treats
tax
smokers
people,
like lepers.
Tax
you know,
people
like
who walk
molesters.
Into a casino. Let's tax
them.
Well, they are taxed. They're going to lose all their money.
I know that.
Let me tell you,
how much of a pack of cigarettes now is taxes? I think cigarettes cost about $10 now, don't they?
I just looked it up. I think they're like $8.59.
We actually have a competitor. Prior to this extra dollar that the legislature is proposing, we actually have a comparatively low cigarette tax compared to other states.
This would put us next to New York.
You're supposed to be Mr. Champion of the Poor over there. And there's a big class issue.
Yes, there is.
I don't believe tax. What about obesity? Are we going to tax people's bad habits? It's just ridiculous.
I actually think, in all seriousness, we should tax things like ice cream and give tax credits for things like broccoli. I know you think we're kidding, but I'm not joking. Can I get back to this for a second? There are two good reasons, even though what you both argue about, the inequity of it, is totally legit. Two things. One, all the evidence suggests that if you raise the cigarette tax, it lowers the percentage of young people who smoke cigarettes. If you start smoking, if you don't start, well, what do you mean you don't believe it? That's what that is. Number two, how about the health care costs? These people cost, and it cost all of us a huge amount
for it.
Let them pay a little more.
Obesity.
They're all
going to
die earlier anyway.
Obesity is a huge problem in terms
I'm
of
serious
our health.
Obesity is a bigger problem. Diabetes is a bigger problem.
Tax fattening foods, yes. And again, I wasn't joking about what's wrong with a broccoli tax credit, Emily Rooney. Maybe a nickel or a dime
or antioxidants.
Whatever
it is.
It's
just the same thing. This is a ridiculous argument because, once again, lots of people eat ice cream and they're not like overweight. So why do you tax the people that are just regular people that want to eat some ice cream?
Because it's bad for you. Good for your head, bad for your body.
You should tax things like margarine.
You know what's
terrible? Those things are bad for you.
You know what's terrible,
too? People eat butter.
And you feel people that are getting off. People use cigarettes. Yes, I'm with you on that, too.
Good.
People use cigarettes that are dealing with trying to stop smoking. I mean, trying to stop drinking or trying to use other drugs. You know, those are people often, you see, if you ever go to an AA meeting or you're outside an AA meeting, what do you see? You see people smoking like furnaces with their Dunkin' Donuts cups.
Okay, I think I won that argument. Engine. Listen, one last thing. I'm told there's one last thing you're fit to be tied about this week. Because of the sequester cuts, virtually every federal employee is going to take somewhere in the neighborhood of a 5% cut. What the president has done is said, I'm going to give 5% of my salary, retroactively, I think to January, I'm not sure, maybe to March, I'm not sure, to the federal treasury so that I'm in the same spot as them. Why isn't that symbolically
John Kerry
a good thing?
Is going to give his 5% to some kind of a fund in his office for people who need... You know, one of the things, this whole thing about vilifying our public and civic employees, I just don't buy it. Most of them are underpaid. Most of
we all
us
agree.
Would not accept the kind of salaries that these people
make. But they're taking a cut, so why shouldn't he take a cut? That's the issue here.
It's stupid. They shouldn't be taking a cut either.
We agree.
They shouldn't be taking a cut. But for the president to get on board, it's like it doesn't mean anything. First of all, the 5% doesn't mean anything to him. Can we just be honest about that? And it just further plays into this notion that every single person working for public service is somehow a hack or on the public till and they don't deserve what they – I don't buy it.
The only idea when I heard Deval Patrick was taking Barack Obama was taking a 5% cut, I took a 5% cut just to say –
No, but
you know what I did like? You know what I did like when Mitt Romney was governor of Massachusetts and he didn't take his salary? I did like that because Mitt Romney's got tons of money.
It.
I know, but I thought that was a very gracious judge. John Kerry does not need his salary either. His wife
but of course
got
he should take it.
$700 million.
And I thought Mitt Romney should have taken it too.
Well,
I mean, it was a symbolic gesture.
He's asking
Teresa taken it
every time he needs $20. So that's why he has to continue to take his salary. But really, he doesn't need it. I think it's more of a
By the way, the place where I disagree, symbolism actually does matter. And while I am totally with you, you don't want government employees who are not getting wealthy, despite what people like Marjorie suggest from time to time.
I never suggested getting wealthy.
Yes, you
none
do.
Of
I resent
think, the early retirement.
Okay, fine. Putting that aside for a second.
Retiring at 50 is a little young.
But that's a whole separate issue. But the underlying notion I am totally with you on is the notion that these people who are probably just feeding their families, going paycheck to paycheck, have to suffer because of the ineptitude of 535 people in Congress.
I don't understand why it's just the civil servants. Why the federal government? It should be everybody. Well, I'll take a 5% cut.
Yeah. Well, I do like the symbolism, though. I think you can't ask your employees to take a 5% cut when you, as the chairman of the board or the president of the country, aren't taking a 5% cut.
Well, I'll take mine in a furlough days.
Here's my solution to the whole pension thing now. I've worked it out. At 50, you start collecting your pension at 65, and you can do another job in the meantime.
Okay, fine. Are you going to be fit to be tied at 7 tonight, or are you not? I just want to know.
We are going to be – Marjorie's relieved that she's not on tonight.
Why is that?
We're going to be talking about the dust-up between the Boston Globe and the Boston Herald over whether reporter Bob Holler, who did that terrific series about the cab drivers and cab drivers and the owners and all that, whether he – misidentified himself or masqueraded, as the Herald put it, as a cab driver when he put on the form, when he filled it out, he said he worked for the NYT company, meaning New York Times Company, which owns the Boston Globe, of course.
And he said his department was sports. Well, he does write sports, but he also obviously works for the Spotlight teams who wrote this too. So it, was there any deception there or not? We'll be discussing that.
I don't even know if Marjorie can watch, much less participate.
I'm DVRing it. I'm DVRing
Emily
it.
Emily Rooney, thanks for your time. We'll be watching tonight at 7. We'll talk to you again next Friday.
All right, you guys.
And tune in Monday for Open Mic, excuse me, with the Reverend Eugene Rivers. Okay, we have Governor Patrick on the line to talk about why he is not buying into the House Senate transportation plan. Please stay tuned for that on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
You're listening to Boston Public Radio. I am Jim Browdy. She is Marjorie Egan. You know, the governor of the Commonwealth is in studio with us next Tuesday from noon to 1, but apparently he just couldn't wait. We'd like to think it has something to do with us. Truth is, it may have something to do with transportation and education funding. Before we introduce him, here's the governor yesterday.
The leadership's proposal is a return to an old way of doing business. It's the same short-term fiscal shell game that got us the big dig and the mess that followed.
And here's a response from a guy who I think he considers his friend, the Speaker of the House, Bob DeLeo.
We're trying to protect the middle class. That is the, I think, one of the major differences of the two plans.
Joining us on the line is the governor of the Commonwealth. Good afternoon, Governor Deval Patrick.
Good afternoon, Jim and Marjorie. How are you both?
Great, thanks.
Thank you for joining us. Governor, sure. We were talking earlier in the week to Charlie Baker, your opponent in the last gubernatorial race, and he said that the legislature's reluctance to back your income tax, 1%, income tax hike and this cut in the sales tax has to do with the fact that you are not running again, but the legislators are, and they're worried about voters' wrath if they approve a big tax hike.
Is that a question?
Do you agree with
it? It's a question. What do you think about that? I mean, it is harder for them than for you.
I think the politics of the legislature's proposal, which is basically to ask everybody to pay more for the same old thing or less, is not just bad policy, but bad politics. And I think that the notion that people are constantly thinking about what the next election is about is precisely what the matter is here. We have to be thinking about what the next generation is about. And whether my number is the right number or my means of getting at it is the right means is sort of beside the point. What the legislature has proposed is different philosophically from what I've proposed because it is about asking everybody to kick in a little bit more so that we can push this problem off for a few more years and then come right back with the whole public even more skeptical than they are today thinking, wait a minute, where did all that money go?
So if the $500 million plan, which has virtually nothing for education, no expansion on the transportation front, just some repair and maintenance, as I think they'd admit, let's assume that were to become law over your objection, potentially over your veto, which you've promised. Tell people concretely, Governor Patrick, in your estimation, what do people get for that $500 million and what will they not get or lose?
Well, they'll get a better balance sheet at the T, but they won't actually get better service. Their 40-year red line cars, you saw that or read that the door was stuck open yesterday while the train was moving. That train doesn't get replaced. They get 30-year-old cars at the on the Orange Line. They get no green line to Medford, which, by the way, is a legal obligation entered into by my predecessor, Governor Romney. There's no way to pay for that. They don't get all of the RTA buses are out of date. All of them, all around the Commonwealth. They don't get any capital improvement for that. The legislature has put in here a $300 million Chapter 90 allowance. This is the local road and bridge program, but not enough revenue to fund it. So they get to say, well, we told the governor to do, or whoever the governor is, $300 million more a year, but there's no revenue to sustain that. It's a shell game. And, the idea of moving people off of the capital budget onto the operating budget is a good idea. It's the right thing to do. It's a part of what I have proposed as well. But we also have to, it seems to me, show some regional equity. meaning that we have to get to all the deferred maintenance in different parts of the Commonwealth, and none of that is addressed in this bill.
Governor Patrick, I've heard you speak glowingly of both the Senate President and the Speaker of the House. They're, obviously, neither of them are stupid people. So what is the explanation? The assumption is that they know what you know. They know the facts as you know them, even if they have a different interpretation. So if you think they're doing a fiscal shell game, if you think they're kicking the can down the road, if they had sodium pentothal administered to both of them today, what would they say? Why would they say they're doing this?
First of all, you've got to ask them that question. You are exactly right when you say that they believe in the importance of the transportation plan that they asked us to do, by the way, and that we spent the last year doing under the leadership of Secretary Davey. They believe in the importance of the investments in education, in early education, in extended learning time for middle schoolers, and in college affordability. They believe in these, publicly and privately. They've always been a little nervous about $1.9 billion. I totally get that. And I have had extensive conversation with them about where the number is that is less than what I've proposed, and certainly more than what they propose, and what are the right ways to get there. But they've made a calculation, as far as I can tell, and I say this acknowledging that this is just what I've been able to discern because I've had no conversation with them since they put their proposal out. That it is somehow better to tax the middle class and give them nothing to show for it, rather than to tax the middle class and give them better transportation, better...
Although you could argue that a 1% tax income tax increase and a reduction by 1.75% in the sales tax is less regressive than many other ways that you could do this. I mean, that's a bonus on your side.
Right. But like I said, look, this is not me saying my way or no way. I'm very proud of the proposal we made, but I've said from the beginning, publicly and privately, that there's more than one way to skin this cat. But there is also such a thing as too small. And if folks are going to take the hard tax vote, it seems to me we ought to be saying to the general public, this is what you're going to get for it. This is what you're going to see, and what the improvement is going to be in your own communities and in your own lives. And they can't say that with this proposal.
Is there a compromise still possible, Governor Patrick, or is it too late?
Well, certainly from my perspective, I've, again, publicly and privately communicated that, there's some place between where I started and where they are right now, which is a responsible place to land that really does make a significant investment in modernizing our transportation system and improving educational opportunities. And that really does get us the job growth that which is frankly what we all need and what we're not going to get with their plan. Now, it's really up to them at this point. I have said what I'm willing to do. What's fascinating is what a rush after a year of asking us to do this work and develop a plan and months of considering my proposal, that they put their proposal out a couple of days ago and are going to insist in the House that they vote on it on Monday without any hearing. We don't even, frankly, know what's behind all of their numbers.
You know, Governor Patrick, a couple of questions about the relationship. I read in the paper this morning what you just said, that you hadn't spoken to them since they came out with their, what they would say is their compromise plan, not what you want. That to me is almost shocking. Have you reached out to them and they've said, I don't want to talk, or why has there been?
It's actually been kind of funny, Jim. I think people have been, there's been a lot of dodging going around in the building right now. And, let me just say, there is always a temptation by the media around here to personalize this. This isn't about me or about the leadership. It's not about the people in Beacon Hill at all. It's about the future of the Commonwealth.
But have you sought a meeting with them?
I have had, let me simply say, we have made every possible overture. Every possible one.
You know, Governor, you said it's not personal. Let me take issue with that just for a second. I spoke to Bob DeLeo shortly after you came out with your package, and he said to me, and I'm sure he said it to everybody, but it's the first time I had heard it, that he knew nothing about the specifics of your plan until he heard you give a speech. And then we read you say in the last 24 hours, you knew nothing about their plan until an hour before their public announcement. isn't it possible there was some resentment on their part about the fact that you came out with this pretty dramatic, pretty big proposal, both in terms of taxing and investing, and they said, hey, it's payback time?
Well, you can ask them that question. I mean, the facts don't exactly bear that out. Remember, we had, I think, 30 hearings around the Commonwealth about transportation, and then a very extensive vetting of a transportation plan, which was then made public several weeks before I made my State of the Commonwealth speech. And in advance of that, I'd said that we wanted to invest in education as well, again, because it is a winning strategy for growing opportunity. Try as you might, Jim, and as interesting as it may be to some of your listeners, this is still not personal as between me and the Speaker of the Senate President. I'm very respectful of them. I respect how hard their job is, and I respect how difficult the vote would be on what I have proposed. But it doesn't have to be my way or no way, but it's got to be something that is more significant and more lasting than what the legislative leadership has put forward.
Let me make more accurate very quickly. When I mentioned Speaker DeLeo saying he didn't know anything until he heard your speech, I meant on the tax side, the income tax raise, hike and the sales tax cut. One last thing, Governor. What shocked me about this is someone who used to do tax politics for a living is there was a stunning amount of public support for a very large tax increase. And my analysis through the years has always been when the legislature is worried about the people back home, that's when they get tax phobic. But this was not a situation where people were doing, the public was doing a knee jerk, just say no kind of thing. So if in that environment with the public apparently being receptive, I get back to, I guess, the first question that Marjorie asked. Why? I mean, we're not talking to them now. We're talking to you. What do you think is the problem?
It's very hard for me to put my finger on it. I mean, it's a you know, we had a couple of conversations, key conversations, the leadership and I, before we went public. And one question I asked them was, tell me what's off the table. Just tell me now so I'm not wasting my time. And that was very helpful to me. And the second thing I asked them was, give whatever I propose some room to breathe so that we can really engage the public in a conversation about what it is they want and what it is what it takes to pay for it. And they were true to that. By the way, we made the same request of many, many media outlets, and all but a couple also gave us that room. And I think because we had that room, people didn't retreat to their usual rhetorical corners, which was really great. And then when Marjorie, it was your paper that had the first poll.
Yep, that showed big support for it.
I
was stunned.
There have been two or three, maybe four since then, within in a couple of cases, even larger margins. So you would think that to the extent public opinion matters to the members of the legislature, they would see some cover in trying to, you know, again, it doesn't have to be mine, but at least something that is significant enough to really grow jobs and modernize these both transportation and education systems.
We know you have to go, and since you said the House of Representatives vote is scheduled for Monday, if people want to weigh in, either on the governor's side or tell their legislators we're happy with what you're doing, the number up there, I think, is 617-722-2000.
That's correct, Jim.
You ask for your rep, and he or she will speak to you. Governor, we really appreciate your time. We'll see you Tuesday at 12 o'clock.
Look forward. Take care.
Governor Deval Patrick, thanks so much.
Thank you very much, Governor Patrick. Okay.
You find, by the way, one of the few times that Governor Patrick has ever been angry at me is when I criticized years and years ago Bob DeLeo. They have a really strong relationship. Do you not find strange this divide, this failure to speak to each other since last week?
I mean,
that's amazing.
But
to me.
I think there's still a lot of skepticism about raising taxes.
Well, sit down and talk then. Meet with the governor. Sit down and talk.
DeLeo is up for re-election, and people keep talking about how much the big dig costs, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Anyway, moving on. What do Dead Fleas, Jay-Z, and Scott Brown have in common? They are all fair game on our Friday news quiz. That's next on Boston Public Radio.
You're listening to Boston Public Radio. I'm Jim Browdy. She's Marjorie Egan. It is the Friday News Quiz. Here are our contestants this week. One contestant would be singer-songwriter extraordinaire who is going to play for you in a little while. That would be Livingston Taylor. Hello again, Livingston.
Ah, Marjorie, Jim, good to see you both.
Good to see
Thank you.
And
Thank you.
I was going to introduce the Herald's Peter Galzinis as just, you know, a columnist. Yeah. But then I find out when I just ask these guys if they knew each other, you reviewed Livingston Taylor when you're a music critic at the Boston Herald?
I may have done that. I know I interviewed him.
How was the interview?
It was wonderful. Really? He was great. He was terrific.
What, do you have any recollection of what he said, or just like is all gone now?
I forget what the context was.
I was flogging some record or right. other. God, no.
I said to him, I asked him if he was still with Don Law, because Law, in the days when I was doing the, Don Law was God. Mm-hmm. You know, he was the... Yeah. He was the promoter, but he was always on scene, too. He was at every venue, and the venues then were mostly the Orpheum and the old music hall. And he was there all the time. And he was the classic preppy with the earth shoes and the
crew neck sweater.
And
Livingston or Don?
No, maybe Don. You too.
Did you have earth shoes, too?
No, I did have some earth shoes. Yeah. For about
15
minutes.
But he remembers that. So. You must remember those days.
I remember those days well.
And he drove the BMW then and the whole big, you know.
So, Livingston, this is where you
Fresh
should
Pond
be
Park
saying the finest interview I've ever experienced was Peter Galzinis in 1942
or whatever it was. I was trying to sneak in a word just to say the finest interview I've ever had.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Until I got to you guys' show.
That's what I was hoping you'd say, too.
Who knew? Who knew Peter Galzinis was a music critic?
Yes, I was.
Who knew?
You didn't know this? He's one of your best buddies.
I didn't know that, actually.
Why don't we have Harold on Herald Crime
Herald
here. You ask questions of Peter Galzinis and I'll be Livingston Taylor.
Okay. Peter, you ready?
Yes.
We're going to play you a song, and then we're going to ask you the question, why are we playing this song? Here it is.
He created jobs for his community.
Okay, Peter.
I like that.
Do you know why we're playing this particular song?
Because Tito's not running for mayor.
That is correct. Now we have a bonus question.
We do?
Yes, we do have a bonus question. Here it is. All the candidates currently who are running, Peter Galzinis.
If you can list them. Go ahead.
Okay, you've got the two Conleys, John and Dan.
Correct.
Yes.
You've got Consalvo.
Yes. Correct.
You have Will Clemens.
Wow.
Ooh.
Whoa.
Oh.
Whoa. I am not worthy.
It's actually Charles Clemens, but
Charles
it's close
Clemens,
enough.
Well, excuse me, I'm sorry. Charles Clemens, Will Forey, I believe.
Oh, no. Wait a minute.
He's pulled out?
No, he hasn't pulled out.
He changed his name.
He changed his name?
Yeah, let's find
out. Oh, no, no, I'm sorry. Will Dorsina.
He's got like nine chances so far.
Okay, all right. I'm sorry. Thank you.
Okay, give him a point or something.
Thank you.
You're missing two, by the way.
I'm missing two.
Yes, you are.
No, he's not. No, there's no, who's that? Felix Arroyo is not in yet.
He's not in yet. He's not in yet.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry.
So you get the points.
You're right. I'm wrong.
Thank you.
Do you know any of those, Livingston Taylor? You didn't?
Yeah. I know John Conley.
That was enough.
Livingston, Cambridge.
You do?
I live in Watertown. Excuse me.
I'm sorry.
It's a different world.
I heard it wasn't earth shoes. It was Birkenstocks.
Birkenstocks.
Is there another big, is there another huge name going to enter this field, Peter Gilbert?
I think Arroyo, I've been chatting with Felix. I think he desperately wants to do it. I think he probably will. I had a chat with Murphy yesterday, who says he's running numbers and whatever that means. Martin is not going to run. I spoke
with Ralph, former Suffolk County DA, not running.
I spoke with him yesterday. He said, you know, he asked me to put that out there today, so I did.
Okay, now, Livingston Taylor, here's your question. I'm living this. You have to name all the city councilors in Watertown. Go ahead. Can you do that? I guess you can. Okay, fine.
No, I can't. Okay. And call me chagrin.
Okay, we're going to do a musical question for you, because you are a musical kind of guy.
I love it when you're doing underhand pitches. That's
whatever
good.
It is. Here it is. Name this rapper in this clip and tell us why he made the ESPN news ticker this week.
It's
at the X with OG at a Yankee game. The shit I made the Yankee hat more famous than a Yankee can. You should know I bleed blue, but I ain't a crypto.
Okay, who's the rapper Livingston Till? He's pretty big. And why is he in the news this week? Go ahead, Livingston.
I only have a guess, and it's not a good guess. Well, we'll when you hear what I play for songs, you will come to understand why this is only a guess. I'm guessing Chris Brown. Is that right?
That'd be wrong. I'm going to give you a hint, though, because Marjorie gave so many hints to Peter Galzinis. He is married to a relatively attractive, high-profile female performer.
I know.
You can't help it.
Kim Kardashian?
That would be...
okay, take it away, Peter.
That would be Jay-Z.
That's right. And why is he in the news?
He's in the news because one of the Yankees, whose name now just flips out of me, decided to go with his management team.
That is exactly correct. Robinson Cano.
Robinson Cano, that's right.
Yeah. Wow.
Go ahead.
What's your favorite... What song of Jay-Z's do you play most frequently, Livingston?
I've got to tell you, I just don't... have a at the drop of a hat.
It doesn't come.
No,
fine.
And by the way, it's not to say that I don't that I when I run into it, I don't like a bit of rap or hip hop. Or it's just it's just not in my my sphere these days.
Don't be so apologetic. Next question, Marjorie for Peter Galzinis.
Peter Galzinis.
Yes,
we have assembled a montage of TV personalities. You're going to hear them right now.
Howdy. Thanks very much. Thanks very much. Good evening. Thank you for letting me come into your homes. Just wanted to say it before you could turn me off. I sneaked in there. We've been having...
Mr. Nixon plays the piano, see. Anyhow, I heard some time ago from a friend of his that he wrote a composition. We have hired about 15 Democratic violinists to fill out the...
This is kind of a strange audience. Have you noticed that? How strange is it? Well, before the show tonight, a suite.
Okay, Peter Galzinis.
Steve Allen, Jack Parr.
Hold on. No. Well,
that's a good answer, too.
But that wasn't the question.
Oh, okay.
Why did we assemble this montage?
Because there's going to be an earth change in the Tonight Show.
That's right. What's going to happen?
Leno is, in a year from now, in April, Leno will surrender it to Jimmy Fallon.
You've been preparing all week, or what?
Man.
I have a little dog, so I sit in my kitchen and watch TV all day.
Okay, you know what we're going to do? We're going to give you the bonus question, Livingston, rather than Peter Galzinis, because we don't like Peter Galzinis' attitude.
Excuse me. He's one of my peeps here.
Can you name...
Hey, this guy was fantastic.
I'm sure.
I
know. Best interview ever.
Yeah,
I know.
He was.
In chronological order, you got a first few. Name every Tonight Show host. I think you can do this.
Well, you gave it away with...
Well, go ahead.
Thanks to Peter. I've got Steve Allen,
yes.
Jack Parr,
yes.
And obviously the last one was Johnny Carson.
No, well, there are more. Well, no, not just that. And who, there have been two more since, one of whom was there very, very briefly, and then the current occupant.
On the Tonight Show.
Yeah, host.
Johnny Carson, obviously Jay Leno is who is
and
there
now. And in
between,
there was a real brief one, and he grew up in Brookline.
Oh.
If you describe the color of his hair, we'll take it.
You got it,
orange.
Peter?
Orange.
It's orange hair, yes. Yeah.
Conan.
Thank you very much.
I didn't remember that.
Yeah.
How long? He was there for what, a month or 2 months or whatever, a couple of months?
Well, obviously he was there, and Jay wanted the spot.
But, you know, I bet Letterman probably logged more time as a substitute host on that show than
O'Brien
best,
did. In terms of nighttime host, Tonight Show or not, who's the best ever, Livingston Taylor?
Maybe it's just because of the years that I watched him and the age that I was. But Johnny Carson
But you had some wild and woolly. I mean, I don't go back to the days when Hoosers did the PM show. Mike Wallace did the PM show in New York, which was pretty incredible. And then there's a clip, because I'm a Phil Spector freak, there's a clip of Phil Spector on the old Merv Griffin show.
Merv Griffin.
At night. Yeah. And it is amazing. Wow. It is an amazing thing. He's with Eartha Kitt, and he and Eartha Kitt are going at it.
Politically, you mean?
Yeah, just in every way. I mean, Eartha Kitt doesn't know what to make of him because he's sitting there with these ruffled cuffs and everything, and he's just acting
crazy. Did you see that movie with Al Pacino?
Yeah, I did.
Was it any good?
Not really. It was based on this documentary called "The Agony and Ecstasy of Phil Spector,"
And in an earlier incarnation, I did the Merv Griffin show.
No, you did. Wow.
I did from Caesar's Palace.
Oh, wow.
In Las Vegas.
Wow. What was that like?
It was unbelievable, and I was on with not only the Mills Brothers, but with Joe Frazier and Muhammad.
Do you have a clip of that?
I do not have a clip of
that.
Did you get to meet him? I was on with...
You met them?
So I'm riding down in the
elevator. He wins. He wins by default.
I'm riding down in the elevator, and here I am, a 23-year-old kid or something, and I'm coming down in the elevator with Muhammad Ali, and I go, Mr. Ali, I'm going to be on the Merv Griffin show with you today. And he goes, just grunts at me a couple of times. And so then Joe Frazier is on because they're promoting a fight.
Right, right.
And so Joe Frazier is on with Merv Griffin. And Muhammad Ali walks up next to me. And as Joe Frazier is speaking, Muhammad Ali becomes animated. He said, look at that fool. He's a fool. Look at that fool. And then here I am, 130 pounds soaking wet. And Muhammad Ali bumps into me. And when Muhammad Ali bumps into you, I'll tell you, laws of physics take over. And I was simply blown across that set.
Merv Griffin and Muhammad Ali.
And I've been run into.
What a memory.
By Muhammad Ali.
Oh,
and it's
that
a great movie.
Great.
That's
a great movie.
It was really
great.
Fun.
Okay, next question is for Livingston Taylor. Livingston Taylor, you have to identify the person using this worn-out metaphor, and what is the person talking about? Take it away.
I want to be clear that I cannot support another effort to kick the can down the road, and I will not.
Okay, who is it, and what would he be talking about, please?
Well, this would be our governor, Deval Patrick,
who you were just speaking with. That's correct.
And he's talking about, of course, this new financing for public transportation.
And whether
it's responsible to do a minor increase.
Give them extra
or
points.
Through the State House, or fund it seriously and well. And I got to tell you, I don't know which side. One would think that, dang, wouldn't it be nice if they were spending the money they were already getting reasonably?
By the way, you're the first person in our 6 weeks on the show to use the word dang. No one has done that before.
Yeah. Dang.
Here's the deal.
Yeah.
Before we move to round two of this match, could you treat us to a little song? And while he's getting his guitar, since you mentioned Muhammad Ali and since you mentioned the Spectre movie,
Here we go.
Greatest documentary ever made, When We Were Kings, about Muhammad Ali fighting in Africa. Who was he fighting?
George Frazier.
No, you interviewed the guy a couple of years later, George Foreman.
George Foreman, that's right, who had the German Shepherd when he got off the airplane.
Exactly, one of the greatest documentaries
was
ever.
Was that Thriller in Manhattan?
No, that was George Frazier.
Was this Rope-A-Dope?
Yes, it was. Yes. It was a great Rope-A-Dope fight. Here is the great, great Livingston Taylor.
Sorry, I'm waiting for a good idea. Hold on. I'll get one in a second. Oh, here we go. This is a song that I was recording yesterday. Alone and awake, I've looked at the stars, the same ones that shine on you. And time and again, I've thought all the things that you were thinking too. Yeah, I doubt Jay-Z has done this one. Yeah, here we go. I have dreamed that your lips are lovely. I have dreamed what a joy you'd be. I have heard every word you whisper when you're close, close to me.
how you look in the glow of evening. I have dreamed and enjoyed the view. In these dreams I've loved you so that by now I think I know what it's like to be loved like you. I would love being loved by you.
Oh, great. Give him 2 points for that, can you?
That was great.
Oh, you said you recorded this yesterday. You're doing a new CD?
Yeah, I am making a new CD.
When's that happening?
Oh gosh, I think I'll be done in a couple of months. You know,
really?
Yeah. I'll be
what
done
is it? Of what? What are you? What are you?
Well, I'm
recording?
Doing songs like I did that song, and I did that lovely Laura Nero song. Let's go down by the grapevine, drink my
song.
Daddy's
oh, yeah.
wine. I could play that in a minute or two.
Let's do that.
Yeah. And so there are a few some new songs of mine, and
what's the show from that? I know this Broadway show.
That is from The King and
Right.
I have dreamed. Yeah, opened on Broadway. When was that? 19? Is that 48?
Yeah.
I know their first production was Oklahoma, opened March 31st, 1943, 77-0. Years ago.
That's pretty great. That's the night you were on the Merv Griffin show, wasn't it, Livingston?
Yeah, amen. Got that
was
right.
Those Livingston. Okay, round two.
You hit that, Jimmy.
Marjorie, next question is for your colleague, Peter Galzinis.
Okay, you ready, Peter?
More music, by the way.
More music. We're going to play you a song.
Yes.
And you get 1 point if you tell us whom the song relates to, and you get another point if you can identify the band behind the song. Here it is. Okay, Peter, what do you think?
The Turning Japanese has to do with Caroline Kennedy being...
Very good. You are on a roll.
Whoa! And I don't... You know something? I wish I should know. I feel mortified to say I know it's like a punk rock band.
I never
don't
heard
know
of
who
them.
It is, though.
Do you know who it is, Livingston, in the group?
I don't know who it is.
I was thinking, I want you to want me. Who did that?
It's not them.
No.
I don't know who it is.
It's
I don't,
the Vapors.
I've heard of the song
Vapors.
Before.
Not Cheap Trick.
Jim
thank
has,
you very much.
Yeah, Cheap Trick. Thank you.
Well, it wasn't me. It was Chelsea said in my ear. Okay, next question.
What are they called?
The Vapors.
The Vapors. Jim has all their work.
I do. One of my five. I've done interviews with them many a time. Now, this is yet another musical question, Livingston Taylor. And you being musical, here it is. Please listen to this clip and tell us what performer the newscaster would be talking about.
She turned down a mill to perform at last summer's Republican National Convention in Tampa, Florida. They told her that they would donate $150,000 towards a domestic violence shelter. The pop star still wouldn't budge.
Okay, who is the pop star, as she calls, who refused, turned down a million or something to perform at the RNC?
The answer is that I don't know, but the notion that there was a domestic abuse component in the offer leads me towards Rihanna. But
it should be Rihanna.
That's actually a great answer, but be wrong.
But other than that, then I would go at that as a backup answer, Taylor Swift.
That would also be
good
wrong.
Good guess.
Good.
I just read all about her boyfriends in Vanity Fair. She was on the cover this month or last month.
Okay, do you have any idea who it is, Peter Galzinis?
Bail me out, buddy boy.
I've got two things, and I'll go with the first one that's probably wrong is Beyonce.
That would be wrong. Do another one just for fun.
All right, just for fun. Madonna?
No, that's also wrong.
That's a tough one.
That's good.
Lady Gaga.
I knew that because I had heard that information.
Brianna
has been
delivering mixed messages in her relationship with Chris Brown.
She has been delivering mixed messages.
I'm going to give you
a trip. Wait a minute. Let me say something here.
Please.
Go ahead.
She's been delivering mixed messages, but There is nothing more inaccurate in the news media than celebrity reporting by its very definition. That's why we become celebrity obsessed.
Yeah.
Because the truth is the least important part of any story about celebrities that is
broadcast. But
you
don't want a piece that is truthful? One of the most shocking things.
Horrible.
After Chris Brown beat the crap out of Rihanna a few years ago, there was a survey, Peter, you'll correct me, or Marjorie, correct me if I'm wrong, of high school kids in Boston. It was in the Boston Globe, and I'm sure you read it anyway, in which virtually the same percentage of teenagers blamed Rihanna for what happened as blame Chris Brown. Now, that, to me, was a really frightening set of results, was it not?
No.
In any case. Okay, one more round. We've got to squeeze in Marjorie Peter Galzinis.
Okay, Peter. Ready?
Yes.
This is German specialist Robert Burke. He was speaking to the BBC on Monday. What's he talking about?
Wie könnte das gehen? Und dann habe ich mit einem Juwelier gesprochen.
I was shocked to find my 300 dead inside their transport box. An expert at a nearby university was able to train 50 in time for the first show. I hope we'll get through this without any more fatalities.
Okay, this is a hard one.
It's not hard at all.
I missed the story completely.
Yeah, I think I did. I don't know. Mice? I don't know.
Well, that's actually not that far off.
Very close.
Kate Livingston.
It's a hard one. It's a very hard one. Not mice.
The only thing I can think is either bees or butterflies.
Oh, you're
even
closer.
I think you got to give it to him for that.
Yeah. I was going to say something. Like that.
Robert Burke is the director of what, Marjorie?
He is the director of a flea circus.
Close enough.
And 300 of his fleas tragically succumbed in a cold snap. It was terrible. They were left in their little cold transport box, and their little legs went right up in the air, and they were on their backs.
By the way, when he was speaking in German, I was thinking to myself, he's giving this away right now. My lack of education is costing me dearly.
Yeah. Okay, this is the last quick question before we hear Laura Nero performed by Livingston Taylor. What, by the way, whatever, how many points? Oh, it's tied 7-7?
Oh, my God.
Is that true? So this means if Livingston gets this right, he wins?
Pressure's on.
This
pressure's
is unbelievable.
No, excuse me. I've been given undue advantage. But go ahead.
Okay, fine.
Nothing new about that.
Who is Stephen Colbert declaring war upon? Here it is.
And folks, this isn't some mamby-pamby war on terror. This is a real war against a nation with an army. Wearing uniforms we recognize and hats so big they double as soup tureens. That is, if they had any soup.
Okay, who is he declaring war upon? That'd be Stephen Colbert, Livingston Taylor.
I'm throwing this to Peter. I don't know.
This is so collegial.
I can give you two answers on that.
No,
and they're both right.
Two answers.
The first one is right, is North Korea.
That is correct.
But the second one he's declared war on is Morning Joe.
Oh, that is another good one, actually.
He has?
Yes, he
Do
has.
Do tell.
Oh, he did a big riff on the fact that they did a suck-up for Mark Sanford, and he also did a brutal thing on our once illustrious Globe columnist who was
now, we should,
on
well,
the
let's,
show.
Let's forget that for a second. Now, the one thing, by the way, for those who don't know, Mark, the Appalachian Trail Sanford, is running against Stephen Colbert's sister for the United States Congress in South Carolina.
Which he does say Elizabeth Colbert Bush.
That's how she pronounces it.
Right, exactly.
And I do believe that Mark Sanford is engaged to the Argentinian.
He is, really?
Yes,
whatever.
She was behind him in that speech.
You know, when I see Sanford, the thing that strikes me most is here's a man who will do anything to be the center of attention.
Yeah,
but
you know,
literally,
politics,
but this is beyond even what's normal.
When you talk about celebrity stuff, though, I mean, you know, it's a lesson in the idea that you know, it's what made Kevin White so great. I mean, you always lean in at the moments where everybody expects you to retreat. You lean in. I mean, he came right out and sort of says, you know, I sinned. And I'm trying again.
Yeah.
And I mean, it's hard. You either say, I think you're a liar, and you know, well, blah blah blah.
I'm not, wait a minute, I'm not remarking on the fact that he should, in fact, run.
Right.
What the thing that just astounds me is a level of narcissism that allows you to do that.
Sure. I'm with you. I'm with you.
Whoa!
There's a place for narcissists in our world too. Now, Peter Gilchrist, would you rather talk about Mark Sanford or hear Livingston Taylor play Moreno?
I'd rather hear Livingston Taylor play.
Okay, as he gets his guitar,
or hear Livingston Taylor play Mark Sanford.
Since he is going to play us out on Monday,
it's all about me.
On Monday, there it is. Globe and Herald writers will debate the political news. Derek Jackson from the Boston Globe has his great column every year. You know, the Final Four is this weekend. He does brackets, not rating teams based upon how good they are, but based upon what the black graduation rate is. Derek Jackson will be with us on Monday. Much more importantly, as we enter the weekend, here he is, Livingston Taylor.
Let's go down by the grapevine, drink my daddy's wine. Good morning. Down by the grapevine, drink my daddy's wine. Good morning. Morning. Oh, sweet blindness, a little magic, a little kindness. Oh, sweet blindness, all over me. Four leaves on a clover, I'm just a bit of a shade hung over. Come on, baby, do a slow float. You're a good-looking riverboat. Ain't that sweet, that blindness good to me?